Lecture 22, Sartre's Being for Others and No Exit.
Almost halfway through Being in Nothingness, Sartre introduces his third ontological category, what he calls Being for Others. 2 points. First, Being for Others, he insists, is on an ontological par with the other two, being for itself and being in itself. So even though the introduction of Being for Others is delayed some 300 pages, its importance and its significance in human nature is just the same as the others. So we kind of break our way from the Descartes view that it's consciousness on the one hand and the world on the other, and now we have a third category which introduces something that Descartes really doesn't talk much about at all, and that is our existence with and for other people. The second point is that the very notion of being for others has a slightly paranoid ring to it. If you think of the contrast, a phrase that Heidegger actually used, being with others, that sounds cozy. It sounds friendly. It sounds non-conflicted. But when you say being for others, right away we get the sense of being used by others. We're there for others as an object, or we're there for others to manipulate. And as you'll see, these paranoid suspicions are not so far-fetched and actually fairly central to Sartre's actual view of this category. In terms of the history of philosophy, and going back to Descartes once again, we might note that there are a series of skeptical problems that have to do not just with the existence of the external world, but also, as I suggested earlier, with the existence of other people. We are only aware of our own consciousness. We are not aware, we cannot be aware, of anyone else's consciousness. So there's a sense in which philosophers have sometimes suggested, in order to take other people as people, what's required is a kind of leap of faith, believing something that we cannot ever possibly prove. Well, of course, philosophers aren't satisfied with this. So over the past 100 years or so, there have been a whole series of attempts to prove the existence of other consciousnesses. And the basic argument, for example, as exemplified in John Stuart Mill, goes like this. I'm conscious, and I have a body, and I notice that my body, when I'm having certain kinds of feelings or thoughts, behaves in a certain way, makes certain gestures, is prone to certain actions, and so on. I see other people, or rather other people's bodies, behaving in much the same way, exemplifying many of the same gestures and facial expressions. And so, by analogy, I conclude that they must have a consciousness, and furthermore, a consciousness much like mine. This raises another set of skeptical problems, which, of course, children have played with for as long as we know, and that is the very thought that maybe other people see things, think of things differently than we do. When I say I see something green, and you say you see something green, how do I know that you're not actually seeing something red? Well, of course, this kind of skepticism is very much fun to play with. And of course, when we start looking at multiculturalism, we realize that it's a kind of skepticism which often has an important truth to it. But to think about knowing that other people exist in terms of any such argument or inference or analogy is really wrong-headed, and in a very important way. First, a problem. With any analogy, it is only so strong as we can verify the likeness on the two sides of the analogy. Or to put it differently, it works as an argument, as an inference, only insofar as we can sometimes confirm that other people's behavior does in fact go along with other people's consciousnesses which are like mine. But of course, that's just what we can't do, because the very point of the Cartesian notion of consciousness is I am aware of and only aware of my own consciousness. But there's a more interesting problem with this argument from analogy, and that is the very idea that we can, first of all, know ourselves and know our own minds. What Sartre wants to say, following from the great German philosopher Hegel, whom we heard of when we were talking about Kierkegaard, Sartre wants to accept the notion that we can know ourselves only with the recognition of other people. The idea is that self-knowledge is not something which Descartes captures as, I think, therefore I am. That, in fact, that is a very late arrival in consciousness and self-consciousness. Rather, as Hegel argues, we become conscious of ourselves, we become self-conscious, only in confrontation with others. And Hegel has a very dramatic story, which we're going to look at in a while, about how we relate to other people in accordance with our need of their recognition. But the basic idea is that consciousness, self-consciousness, and consciousness of others all comes at once as a single package. We don't first of all know ourselves and then get to know other people or think we know other people. Rather, in order to know ourselves, we are already presuming what Sartre calls being for others. This knowledge comes not from any kind of observation on our part, not from comparing ourselves with other people and comparing our gestures and actions with theirs, but rather our knowledge comes from the experience of being looked at. And let me go back to that experience of shame which I talked about briefly in an earlier lecture. There's a sense in which shame is the conduit. It is a basic way of knowing that we exist and that other people exist. One notes here that our experience with other people through shame is not a particularly happy one. And thus again, the idea of being for others rather than the idea of being with others. In a sense, when we are looked at, we are caught, we are objectified. And Sartre has a number of examples of this, both in Being and Nothingness and in his later works. But let me for the moment pick one from a later work in which he writes a biography of Jean Genet, the great playwright, but also a rather perverse felon. And he captures Genet in his childhood, trying to understand what it is that made him into the strange person that he would become. As always with Sartre, we can expect that it's not going to be simply in terms of upbringing, in terms of the causal forces at work that are going to determine what he will become, but rather it's going to be in terms of Genet's choices about what he will become in the context of his situation and circumstances. So the story, as Sartre tells it, is that here's this young boy who is doing what young boys often do, not paying much attention to the mature notion of private property, and just sort of casually rooting through an adult's drawer, looking for something to steal. He's doing this very unreflectively, undeliberately, one might even say unselfconsciously. Like the example where I'm running for a bus or a streetcar, and what I experience is only the streetcar or bus to be overtaken. Here is the young Genet rooting through a drawer, and if we were phenomenologically to describe his experience, what we describe is basically just the contents of the drawer. And here is something, here is something else. Anyway, into this scene, an adult appears, and the adult screams, "Thief!" And as Sartre puts it rather lyrically, the young Genet is pinned as a butterfly to a display. It's an experience we all have in many different aspects. It's one that captures the example in Being in Nothingness, in which we are also pinned in just this way. The example in Being in Nothingness is something, I guess, equally perverse, but it's the example of our looking through a keyhole. Now remember, we're talking in the 1940s when keyholes weren't these small electronic things that we have today, but keyholes were these rather large holes through which one put a rather substantial key. And of course, one of the obvious things about such a keyhole is that one can look through it and see what's on the other side. Anyway, one imagines oneself kneeling down by the keyhole, looking at the scene, presumably something which is private, on the other side. And if one were to describe one's phenomenology at that moment, one would describe, well, perhaps the shape of the keyhole and then the scene at the other end. But it would not be a scene captured by the notion of self-consciousness, certainly not reflective self-consciousness at all. But suddenly there's a creak on the stairwell, and one turns around and sees that someone has caught him in the act. Well, At that point, the phenomenology changes dramatically. One is thrown into self-consciousness. One is thrown into reflection. One is thrown into seeing oneself as the other person sees one. So just as Genet is caught rooting through the drawer, and he's labeled a thief, and his decision to accept that label is what determines his next existence. In the case where we are caught on the stairs, being essentially a voyeur, that being caught, in a way, determines who we are. Now, as always with Sartre, who we are is an ambiguous notion. It's who we are in the eyes of the person who has caught us, and what's so painful about such a circumstance is we realize that even if this was a momentary lapse in our behavior, in the mind of this person who has seen us, perhaps seen us for the first time, this is going to be our essence. This is who we really are, a pervert, a voyeur. But we are also the way we see ourselves, because we are being for itself, we have a transcendence, and we know that this one fact, especially if this is the only time we've ever done such a thing, this one fact doesn't define us at all, but rather I define myself in terms of my ideals and the kind of person I think of myself as wanting to be. I think of myself as a moral person. I think of myself as a person who respects privacy. And so this act does not define me in my own mind. And nevertheless, I am painfully aware of the fact itself, which would seem to dictate, quite apart from whether anyone else has caught me or not, that I am, at least in this instance, a voyeur. In fact, in some cases, I catch myself. In a way, this is what moral education is all about. A child, we depend on other people to catch us in the act and tell us, this is wrong, you shouldn't act this way, you don't want to be a such and such. But of course, once we've been through that, we have what Heidegger and many people through the tradition call conscience. And the nature of conscience is that in effect, we tell ourselves, we catch ourselves doing or tending to do certain kinds of actions, and we stop ourselves. So there's a sense in which being for others really is just that. There's a sense in which being for others is being pinned, being identified, being objectified in terms of the perceptions and judgments of other people. Once again, we can go back to Camus and the stranger, and we go to the scene where the old people are sort of ushering into the room, and Rousseau has the absurd thought that they are sitting in judgment of him. And of course, that turns out to be absolutely true, as it is more explicitly true in the second part of the novel when he is actually on trial. But the thesis here is we are all always on trial. We are always in the eyes of others, even if we have internalized those eyes so that, in fact, it's our own self-consciousness which imposes those external judgments. Now, there is a very strong tendency in individualistic societies, particularly in this one, for people to fight off the influence of other people and to act independently and for themselves. We've seen this in these lectures, particularly in the philosophies of Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. For Kierkegaard, it is of the utmost importance that one is a Christian not because other people are Christians, but one is a Christian because one has decided all by oneself that that is what one is going to do. In Nietzsche, the attack on the herd sometimes becomes downright vicious, and the idea is that one is truly oneself. One can exercise one's talents and become who one is only by exercising the influence of the absurd, or to put it in modern terminology, not caring what other people think. What Sartre is arguing here, and Sartre certainly is an individualist as much as any of these others, but Sartre is arguing that we cannot be indifferent to what other people think, that what other people think of us is as much a part of our identity as any of the other ways in which we know ourselves, thinking of ourselves in terms of the facts of the case, thinking of ourselves in terms of our own plans and expectations. What other people think of us is a clear determinant of who we are. And so the kind of tension we talked about in the lecture on bad faith now becomes not a polar tension, but a three-way tension. We talked before about facticity versus transcendence and how we're always both but the one tends to compromise or circumscribe the other. And so we're always pulled between seeing ourselves too much in terms of our facticity, too much in terms of our choices, plans, expectations, so on. Now we have to expand that picture, because in addition to how we think about ourselves and what the facts would seem to make true of us, there is also this question about how other people see us. And so bad faith takes on a new dimension too. One way we can ban bad faith is we can accept what other people think of us as simply the truth. And we can define ourselves just in terms of who we are for others. This, of course, is what Heidegger is talking about when he talks about the Das Mann self, the anonymous self, the sense in which we are not taking charge of our own existence, but simply going along with the views and roles of others. Or conversely, one can be in bad faith in exactly the opposite way. One can say, as I said a moment ago, I don't care what other people think. That's bad faith because you cannot help but take account of what other people think. Some people would say, well, this is just kind of a psychological fact, and it's a psychological fact that's more true of some people than others. Sartre would want to counter. It's not psychology, and it's not something that is peculiar to this or that individual. It is part of the very essence of being human, that we are, if you like, social creatures, not in the rather benign community sense that someone like Aristotle defended long ago, but in the rather perverse and disturbing sense that we are the objects of other people's judgments, and the way we identify ourselves is very much part of how we are judged by other people. So what we find here is that, as Camus discovered, and as Heidegger discovers in a slightly different way, that there's a sense in which we are all guilty. What are we guilty of? Well, if you think about the shame example, if you think about the very idea of being judged by others, we are guilty both of not living up to other people's expectations of us, or sometimes we do live up to their expectations, which are very low, and then we find ourselves feeling guilty for not living up to our own expectations. And that's the trap that Heidegger tries to get us out of. For Sartre, it really does take on very much the appearance of another version of the doctrine of original sin, in a purely secular way, of course. But just as we are incapable of getting out of bad faith, because we always emphasize facticity versus transcendence and so on, so too, we are incapable of avoiding bad faith in the sense that we can never get straight, as we would like to, about how much we should or how much we should not take our identity of ourselves to be in the hands and eyes of other people. To summarize this view, Sartre comes up with a couple striking formulations. One, in being in nothingness, is that our relationship with other people is basically conflict, quite the contrary of the rather amiable sense of community that Aristotle and other philosophers have defended. What Sartre tells us is that our relationship with other people is always, in a way, trying to set aside their judgments of us, or getting them to make judgments of us, which are in line with our own judgments of ourselves. And consequently, we're always sort of playing with great difficulty with other people and the extent to which we can control them and their judgments, the extent to which they can control us and our judgments of them. And this is prone to be a very conflicted situation, since while we can all think of examples in which I think well of you, you think well of me, let's go have a beer, just as often, particularly in anything in which there is the least bit of competition, there is going to be this sense of, well, I'm better than you, let me prove it. No, I'm better than you, let me prove it. And that can take all sorts of dimensions. And we've seen that operate in every theater of human experience, and we'll talk about some of them in the next two lectures. Perhaps the most striking illustration of this, and the best slogan to sum it up, is Sartre's play, No Exit. The phrase is, hell is other people. And the play itself is set in hell, and it really has a kind of diabolical setting. One should add that if it weren't for Sartre's philosophy permeating it, it could well be a piece of kitsch and not a very interesting play at all. But because it's a rather intriguing mix of, on the one hand, theatrical setting, and on the other, philosophical profundity, No Exit, I think, is often received as one of philosophy's most profound contributions to the theater. Anyway, the setting. It's hell. The three people who are its principals are dead. Now, Sartre, of course, is an atheist. He doesn't believe in heaven and hell. He doesn't believe in an afterlife. So one can already anticipate that the whole play is written rather tongue-in-cheek. The three people are picked for precisely their incompatibility. One, the male of the group, named Garcin. He is a man who has always conceived of himself as a hero. In fact, he has spent his life in the underground in some unnamed South American country, in the resistance at war with an authoritarian government. He is also something of a libertine, and among his most serious defects are a kind of cruelty to women, and in particular, extreme cruelty to his wife. His situation is that just before he died, he was arrested. And as he was arrested, while he was in fact running from the police, he was about to be executed when he broke down in tears and, like a small child crying for mercy, was the very antithesis of heroic. And then he was shot. And the question that plagues him is the question, am I a coward or am I a hero? This is a kind of question which has often fascinated me in terms of our conception of our dying moments, something that goes back to the Greeks. One also finds it, of course, in Western cowboy ethics. But the idea that how a person dies is in some sense definitive of his or her life. Or to take a more literary source, in Goethe's Faust, at the very end, as Faust is about to die, he repents. And in that last moment, some angels come down and pick up his worm of the soul and carry it off to heaven, despite his pact with Mephistopheles. And one wants to ask, does a last-minute bit of repentance really undo a lifetime, in this case, of bargain with the devil? Or in the cowboy ancient morality plays, is it true that how a person dies with his boots and his gun on, for example, does that really say something about the life? Or is it just one moment among others? Anyway, these are the sorts of thoughts that Garcin is struggling with. On the one hand, there's 30 years of undisputed heroism. On the other hand, there is this very cowardly death. So what is he? And part of Sartre's thesis here is that as long as we are alive, as long as we are dynamic selves in the making, there is no such thing as what we are, in other words, pure facticity. But of course, when we're dead, we are pure facticity. And the question now for Garcin is, what is it? Is it a coward? Is it a hero? And of course, part of the intrigue of the play is the fact that here we have a character who, on the one hand, is dead, but at the same time is reflecting and dynamically interacting with others, trying to decide who it is that he is or was. The other two characters are both women, but they're women who are very different from one another. Estelle is a kind of high society flit. She is a coquette. She has lived her life in the eyes of men and being desired by men. She, in fact, killed both her husband and her baby, which is why she's in hell. But her behavior hasn't really changed. She comes to hell rather well-dressed, still very beautiful, and what she wants, as she's always wanted, is a man. And there's only one man around, that's Garcin. But his mind is on other matters. And then there is Inez. Inez is a lesbian and from a fairly humble working class background. She's not apologetic for either of those. She takes her lesbianism, unlike Sartre's homosexual and being in nothingness, as simply a fact about her, and she has no qualms about it. As for her working class status, she wears that with a kind of pride, not something to be ashamed of at all, even in the face of Estelle's high society flirtations. Inez is in hell because she murdered her lover and also committed suicide at the same time. And so they're quite a trio. And if we imagine a dinner party in hell, this would be it. Because Garcin, while he's totally absorbed with his worries about who he is or was, at the same time is the same macho libertinish fellow who was so cruel to his wife and so many other women. I might add, just as a footnote, the first production of the play, it was Camus who played the character of Garcin. And then there's Estelle, who cares about nothing so much as regaining her own identity, which has to be through the recognition and desire of a man. But Garcin's the only one around. And then Inez, who is very desirous of Estelle, something, a thought which she is unwilling to entertain. The triangle here is guaranteed to produce conflict. But of course, Sartre's point is that it's a conflict which goes on between us all the time, although perhaps in much more subtle ways. In one of the key scenes in the play, Estelle discovers that in hell, she has no mirror. As she puts it, they must have taken it away from her at the entrance. There are no mirrors in the room either. And of course, for a person who has lived by her looks all of her mature life, this is a serious deficiency. Inez at this point steps in and says, "Let me be your mirror, dear." And of course, the symbolism here is very complex and profound. You remember when we were talking about reflection in the context of the stranger, and I talked about the kind of dual image of reflection, as on the one hand, looking at oneself as if looking at another, and at the same time, the idea of reflection in the mirror, and putting these two senses together in the idea of seeing oneself as another would see you, as if in a mirror. Well, the truth is that mirrors aren't all straight. There are all sorts of distorting mirrors. And as Inez makes very clear, looking at yourself through the consciousness of another person is deeply distorting, and it has to do a great deal with their prejudices and desires. And of course, Inez is filled with prejudices against Estelle's upper-class status and also more immediate desires for her. So as Estelle starts asking questions like, "How do I look?" Inez starts becoming a rather uppity mirror and says at one point, for example, "Oh, is that a pimple?" And Estelle, of course, freaks out. Inez says, "I was just kidding." But the idea is, what if your mirror started to lie to you? And of course, what's at stake here is the way we all lie to each other, either willfully or just in seeing people and judging people and dealing with people in our own terms rather than in their terms. The upshot of the play, therefore, is that hell is other people, precisely in the sense that if we were each alone, as Garcin tries to be several times in the play, but of course unsuccessfully, we might be able to satisfy ourselves with our own conceptions of ourselves. But as long as we're with other people, and we are always with other people, what we're going to find is that our conceptions of ourselves are always compromised by and determined by other people as well. What No Exit gives us is a very graphic illustration of the kind of conflict that all human relationships are subject to. In a passage in Being and Nothingness, Sartre points out that when we're alone, let's say walking through a beautiful desert landscape in Arizona, and there's a sense in which we have this feeling, the world is mine. And although this is probably more aesthetic and reflective than Heidegger would be talking about in his introduction of Dasein, one can look at oneself alone in a beautiful landscape and feeling very much at one, at home with the world, as a kind of paradigm of what it is to be Dasein. But, in Sartre's example, suddenly we see another person coming over the horizon. And it doesn't much matter yet whether he or she has seen us. As soon as we see them, we understand that our world has been disrupted. That, as Sartre puts it rather over graphically, our world, our personal, private unity with the world, has just been absorbed down the drain of another person's consciousness. Well, overly dramatic, perhaps. But it's an experience, again, that I think we all find familiar. We are alone, quite content with our circumstances. Another person comes on the scene, and suddenly we're thrown into viewing ourselves as the other person might view us, and that is something from that point on that we have to deal with. So, being for others is essentially a third consideration in the question, what is it to be a self? It's not enough to look at the facts that are true. It's not enough to simply see what I think of myself. But I also have to take into consideration how others view me. And as always in Sartre, these three views are in tension, and there is no simple way to find out simply who I am.